Hello and welcome to Volume 93 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about how to quantify the services that your forest provides, how hunting has changed, and not for the good, according to one guest. We'll talk about handling wild hogs, and we'll talk about mills, which are not willing to make long-term price commitments for your wood. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. People from all over the world have been made aware of the damaging tornadoes which ripped through Alabama in April. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has taken aerial imageries of these areas, and so we have John Sellers, who's a cartographer for NOAA, with us. Hello, John.
Hey, how are you doing today?
How much imagery did NOAA collect after the tornadoes on April 27th, and how is that imagery being used?
We collected a little over 3,000 digital images from an altitude of approximately 5,000 feet above ground level. The images were then combined into 717 seamless mosaic tiles with a ground sample distance, basically the size of each pixel on the ground, of approximately 10 inches. The images have been used by first responders, the Alabama National Guard, and the National Weather Service for things ranging from search and rescue to damage assessment. And since it is a public domain resource, it can be used by anyone, from universities doing research to commercial interests who may want to value-add and repackage the data.
Okay. How does someone access the image, and how long is it going to be up?
Well, the two primary means of getting to the data would be through our website or through the United States Geological Survey, and both of those links are right there on the web page, along with a short description of how to use the websites to get to the data that you want. Basically, once you get to our website, you will see a map of the affected areas and a series of red tiles. Each of those tiles is one of those mosaic images that we processed. You can zoom in, zoom out, and move around on the map until you get to an area that you are interested in. And then by clicking on one of the tiles, a information bubble will pop up that allows you to view the image thumbnail or the full resolution image. Clicking on that link will make the image pop up in a new window in your browser. Some of those full-resolution images are pretty big, so make use of the thumbnails.
Are y'all taking photos only of the tornado-damaged areas?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What other sources are available to the public to look at these tornado-damaged areas?
One last thing on that last question.
Okay.
We collected imagery in 2003 and of Hurricane Isabel, and that's still on the website, so we keep it up there for a pretty good amount of time.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
And
all
then
other sources of data.
Yes, sir. Through the United States Geological Survey website, you can get not only our imagery, but satellite imagery and aerial imagery from other vendors.
Okay. All right. Thank you, John. We appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
The Georgia Forestry Association has undertaken some research into the value of ecosystem services that are provided by forests. This quantifies the monetary value of things like clean air, clean water, and the like. And these are things that forests provide the public, but the public doesn't pay for it. And we have the president of the Georgia Forestry Association, Steve McWilliams, with us. Hello, Steve.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Where did this idea for doing this research into ecosystem services originate?
Well, when I joined the Georgia Forestry Association probably about 8 years ago now, I stumbled upon a study that had been done by the West Hill Foundation for Nature and had been done by the World Resources Institute, in which the same thing had been done, but on a sort of a macro scale. And it occurred to me that if we were going to really use that kind of information for the state of Georgia, that we needed to have research done specific to the state of Georgia, demonstrating the ecosystem services values that our 24 million acres of forest bring to not just to the forest industry but to the public. So that's where it originated, finding something and then trying to narrow it down so that it would resonate with folks here in Georgia.
Okay. Georgia, by the way, Georgia's and Alabama's forests are very similar to one another. Why did you believe this project was necessary?
Well, part of what we do at the Georgia Forestry Association, a great part of it, is advocacy, and particularly before the state legislature. And I, for a long time, when we would present testimony and all, we would end our testimony describing the forest industry as being a $27 billion industry, and then sort of as a little tag, we would say, and of course, they're all so these economic, environmental, and ecosystem service benefits, but we were never able to put a number to that. And so in order for us to have more impact in terms of our advocacy, we felt it important that we be able to put a number to it. And, of course, the number is huge, $37 billion of value of these ecosystem services provided in Georgia alone. In our forests. And so as members of the legislature and other decision makers, as they make decisions that that impact land use, they need to know the full story. And without the value of the ecosystem services, in addition to the economic value of the manufacturing from wood and fiber, we needed to have that figure.
What do you think the major benefits are going to be to this study?
Well, I think that there are a couple of them. I think better decision making, as I mentioned, we in Georgia, and perhaps because of having Atlanta here and the major population shifts to the urban area, we have a real challenge in educating folks who are going into public service, particularly at the state level, who don't have an orientation to rural Georgia and to the industries and cultures of rural Georgia. And this is going to help us better educate them so that they take into account all of the values and all the benefits of forests when they make decisions that affect the forest. Not only that, there were about 20 different companies, nonprofit agencies, government agencies who paid, put some skin in the game to conduct this research. And that kind of cooperative effort among all of those different groups had never, at least in my experience, had never happened before. So we expect it's going to set us up for additional cooperation among a number of groups who historically have been at odds with one another over environmental issues.
All right. Well, thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. One of the traditionally valuable products produced from forests is wood flooring. The southern pine flooring is sought by home builders throughout the world, and we're pleased to have a representative from the Southern Forest Products Association, Russell Richardson, with us. Hello, Russell.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
First, tell us a little bit about the wood flooring market and southern pine flooring in particular.
Well, the wood flooring market is pretty big. It's about, last reports I've seen, about 30 billion square feet. And in terms of wood products, we're about a little over 10% of that. And inside that, southern pine flooring market is just a niche market of that, a little under 1%. So there's a lot of market share that can be gained in terms of marketing the southern pine species to the flooring market. So one of the things that I do is go to the National Wood Flooring Association Expo every year, and that is coming to the South for the next 3 years, so that will be definitely a benefit to the southern pine flooring manufacturers.
Okay. Is there anything special about the trees that southern pine flooring is made from?
Yeah, that's generally your flooring products. You know, those are based on appearance grades, and they're going to come from your higher quality trees. Generally in the markets you hear people talk about longleaf, the longleaf species. That tree tends to produce a more quality log. Myself, I'm part of a family of forest, and we're planting longleaf for that type of production. So it's a higher quality tree. Maybe takes a little longer to grow than your first cuts there. That's where people look to get the flooring product from. The companies do.
Well, forest landowners are removed to some extent from the marketing efforts that take place in the wood products side of things. Tell us why you think wood product marketing is important to us as forest landowners.
Well, it's important to continue to market our products even in these down times, especially, you know, if you take southern pine flooring, for example, you know, people or companies are looking to differentiate themselves in their markets. And you know, in the flooring markets where, you know, is dominated by red oaks and other hardwoods, they come across a species like southern pine, and it's a chance to show the customer a different product. And, you know, if you use flooring as an example, and it can apply to all the different southern pine products that are out there, including dimension lumber or whatever it may be, those marketing those products, you know, will help drive revenues back to the companies, which will end up back in the landowner's hands. So we have to continue to market our products and increase that demand to drive value to our forest.
Okay, thank you, Russell. Forest owners are people who have to wait many years with no income for an occasional year with income from a timber sale, and since we don't have the same tax rate applicable to all income levels, this can result in an unfairly high tax rate when you consider the many years that would go without any income. And so income averaging is the solution, and Frank Stewart's here to talk about it. Hello, Frank.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
In some circles, this movement is called the reestablishment of income averaging for forest landowners. Why is that?
Because before 1986, landowners were allowed to average their income for over a five-year period if they had a spike in income due to a timber harvest. Most landowners only have a timber harvest once or twice in their lifetimes, and very often, according to statistical analysis, to fund retirement, college education for children, or maybe even a devastating illness. We want to reestablish that income averaging now to overcome what it was an unintended consequence of the Congress when they passed the reforms in 1986 to disallow some securities loophole, securities trading tax loopholes. Farmers and fishermen have already worked to reestablish their income averaging, and they can do it over 3 years now.
Okay, but timber owners can't currently. Farmers and fishermen can. You'd like
that's
to include forestry in that circle. Why do you think that's important to the economy and to the American public in general?
Well, we believe that markets and incentives for forest landowners enable the continuation of the ownership and perpetuation of forest land in the United States. What may be seen as an extraordinary benefit to landowners is already realized by farmers and fishermen, and the Congress already understands the need for that. I think they also would understand, and the ones we've talked to understand, that there is a need to create some incentives to own forest land and not just what we see sometimes as disincentives.
Is this included in anyone's bill at the moment, or is there any actual movement on it, or is it something that we're talking about at the moment?
It has been introduced in the last two Congresses. It has not been introduced in this Congress as yet, but it is in the form of a bill. And we are, at this point, recruiting allied organizations to help us push this through the Congress when we do decide to do it.
Okay, Frank, we hope you'll keep us posted on that as the situation develops. We appreciate you joining us. Now, to make a transition from the IRS to wild hogs is an easy one to make, and that's what we just did because our next guest is an extension specialist with Mississippi State University who specializes in wild pig management or control, as it's sometimes called. Bronson Strickland is with us. Hello, Dr. Strickland.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on the program.
How many states now have a significant wild pig population?
Currently, our best estimate is at least 38 states in the nation and possibly as many as 40. And that results in an estimated damage caused by these wild pigs of over $1 billion to agriculture and to the environment. And within the environment, that includes forestry.
Okay. How fast is the population growing in these states that you're talking about?
We took a little bit closer look in Mississippi, and I'm sure the exact same trends are going to occur in Alabama and Georgia as well. But looking at what data we have in Mississippi, currently about 38% of the land area in Mississippi is potentially occupied by wild pigs. And if you look at that rate of expansion over about the last 20 years, that's about 500,000 acres a year are being occupied by wild pigs.
Some people might not know what type damage is caused by a pig. Is a pig a benign little creature that you'd like to have on your forest, or is it something you'd rather get rid of?
It should be enemy number one, whether it's directly to forestry, I mean actually damaging seedlings or trees, whether you're interested in wildlife conservation, the impacts and the competition they have for foods with wildlife, and of course if you're a farmer, of course that's the most obvious example there. If you're trying to raise corn or soybeans or peanuts and you have a wild pig population nearby, you're going to have a lot of damage caused by these pig populations. So not benign at all.
Not something to trifle with. You need to take. What are you guys at Mississippi State doing about it?
We are trying to teach people to be as proactive as possible. We're trying to spread the word best we can. And what we tell landowners is to take this very, very seriously. Spread the word with adjacent landowners. Form landowner cooperatives. And to help do that, we developed a website that we tried to be as comprehensive as we could to be a clearinghouse for all the information that they have. So we have a website called wildpiginfo.com. And on that website, you can go there, and we have two different publications, a technical guide for natural resource professionals, a landowner guide for landowners that show them more hands-on stuff of what they can do. And we also have some videos there. And all that information, the publications, are free for download in PDF form, and you can forward them on via email to someone else, and then also the videos as well. You can look at them free of charge on there and forward the link to anyone that you think might be interested.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Strickland. Appreciate you joining us. Alan Houston is a research professor in the Department of Forestry, Wildlife, and Fisheries at the University of Tennessee, and he's observed the sport of hunting over the years and has some interesting observations to share. Welcome, Alan.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Hunting is changing, isn't it? What are some of the changes that you've seen over the last 25 years?
Well, I guess the biggest change is moving toward lease arrangements for private landowners. But with that, and in the last number of years, I think there's been an increasing focus on big deer, big bucks.
Okay. Well, from a landowner's perspective, that's oftentimes what they're trying to grow and produce. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, there, I don't know. It's just kind of a trajectory, a trend, and certainly being able to extract income, you know, is from the forest is the way or a way to keep the forest a working forest and let it earn its keep. Mm-hmm. But anytime market forces lean against something, there'll be an attempt to improve it, and here we're improving hunting. And QDM, for example, is a good thing. It manages the whole herd. But we're sort of moving away from, I think, in a segment of our hunting, from I'll pay for a chance at a big deer to I'll pay for a big deer. And when you move toward that, it's kind of irresistible ground. It's kind of an economic vacuum, and it'll suck us in. As a researcher, what I think is that we're sort of moving toward elements of risk and benefit in hunting that have not been rigorously explored. And I think the end of that spectrum, or at least the end that I can see, is high fencing operations or deer farming, where deer are genetic manipulations and feeding to create bucks are just outrageous, essentially unnatural horns.
Well, what is at risk if we focus on that end of the spectrum, the narrow end of the spectrum related to hunting?
Well, you know, if hunting becomes less enticing, a question becomes, will forests be at risk and will the wildlife populations be at risk? We're losing our hunting population. There have been, and it seems that the trend will continue, that there are fewer hunters all along.
What is what's causing the reduction in the number of hunters?
Well, I'm not entirely clear. Richard Liu wrote a book about nature deprivation, and he talked about it's sort of a social dynamic. It's kind of a moving target, and demographics has something to do with it. We're no longer a rural society. Kids play indoors. But this is more philosophic. It sort of gets to the center of what I'm talking about. And it seems like any cheapening of the experience, any creeping insistence that, you know, what we would call hunting's reasonable expectation of success can be replaced by a guarantee, I don't think is moving the way that we ought to move. And here's what I think. I think in eventually it will be valued less by potential hunters, and it'll be probably criticized eventually by non-hunters.
What would an average landowner do to keep the good values of hunting alive so that the sport continues to grow?
Well, you know, a deer stand really does exist in a global market. It really does. China can't make it. And for a landowner, a buck is sort of like a pixel in the charts and graphs to predict the world's wealth and their wealth and the sustainability of hunting. But it's going to be tough to cash in well without making it ugly. And partly it's going to be the hunting community. They'll have to look really closely at their sport and act as guardians. And I believe we need to preserve the values of woodsmanship that make hunting so fascinating in the first place. And, you know, a box stand's a fine place to be, but it's not only the place to be. And tracks and deer sign, the things that get kids really involved, squirrels and rabbits, they were my initiations that went with hunting. I think it may be a mistake for a child's first experience to be a deer at 100 yards, but I really do believe that it's almost certainly a mistake for it to be his only experience.
All right. Well, thank you, Alan. I appreciate you joining us. Well, with the cyclical downturn in pulp and lumber prices and the utter collapse of the cap-and-trade-based carbon sequestration markets, it's tempting to think about whether it's worth it at all to plant trees. Josh Love has studied whether it still pays to plant trees, and he's with us. Hello, Josh.
Hello, good to be here.
What factors prompted you to examine this issue of whether it still pays to plant pine trees?
Well, really, what's prompted this is the questions we're getting from our customers, and that means our foresters and our landowners that we serve. We all know that, as you mentioned, that we're seeing reforesting rates have been dropping for the last decade. There's a lot of reasons for that. We know that from FIA that fewer harvested acres are being actively replanted. And we're getting the questions, well, what can we do about this? There's a lot of folks that might be on the fence on this. And that's really what prompted that, a lot of that anecdotal evidence. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of questions about this emerging biomass market. Is this going to be something that's going to make sense for us? Under what circumstances can this help us kind of pull us out of this hole that we seem to be in? So those are really what prompted us to take a look at this.
What did you find out? What are the results?
Well, the results, you know, we looked at the article that you've discussed is something that is pretty complicated. And today, you know, we just want to talk about really a conventional regime. Really, we looked at a loblolly pine plantation, very modest assumptions in the upper coastal plain in terms of cost of seedlings and all those different types of things. And certainly you can read the article to get a better idea of those assumptions, but very modest. And really what we found is that even under current prices, adding in an annual hunting lease at $7 an acre, we can still generate some pretty good returns on our investment. Rates of return, we evaluated this over a number of site indices from 50, which is very low, all the way to 80, which is very high. Even at a site index of 50, with a single thinning and a clear cut, we're looking at still getting about 7% rate of return, which is pretty fair considering a hurdle rate that's pretty reasonable at this point in time might be 5 or 6%. On an average site, a site 65 or so, we're still yielding about 10%, which is pretty good. And on a really high site, you know, we're looking at some pretty high returns, around 13%.
To what extent are those returns, if at all, dependent on government-mandated and subsidized bioenergy markets for these financial returns?
Well, you know, we did take a look at that. The numbers I just threw at you, those are really looking at just a very without biomass.
Okay, traditional markets.
There's been a lot of interest in looking at residuals, logging residuals, and using those as biomass, mm-hmm. sort of integrating that into a traditional management regime. And really, you know, those do have a positive impact, but it's pretty small. Looking at between 2 and 5% increase in net revenues is what we're looking at given the current biomass prices or what we foresee as being biomass prices. So they do have a positive impact. It's not real significant. But that doesn't factor in any potential cost share incentive payment programs or price matching cost payment cost matching programs that might emerge and may emerge in the future.
And are hard to predict, I guess.
Yes, sir.
Does the Georgia Forestry Commission have any other tools that can help landowners estimate these financial returns you're talking about?
Yeah, we've developed a spreadsheet tool which is appropriate for the whole state of Georgia, and I think it's relatively appropriate for Alabama as well, that's going to allow landowners that have some inventory data or maybe some projected inventory data in terms of stumpage yields and things of that nature, that's going to allow them to, one, you know, evaluate financially what they're looking at, calculating sort of those metrics, net present value, bare land value, internal rate of return, those types of metrics, as well as calculating biomass as well. So if we've given current, if we've got a product of a certain amount of yield that we have estimated, we can use that to estimate how much additional biomass residual might be on site as well. So that, I think that's pretty helpful.
Okay, good. All right, thank you, Josh.
Thanks.
I appreciate you being with us. Well, we're honored to have Ed Travis in our markets chair today. Ed Travis calls it as he sees it, and the way he sees it, markets for wood are tightening so much that mills are not willing to make long-term price commitments to the people selling wood to them, and that's a problem. Hello, Ed. How are you?
Hello.
First, let's talk about the dynamics when you sell wood, and I'd like to review the difference between a lump sum and a pay-as-cut sale before we go into our main topic.
Oh, that's fine, Hayes. Just briefly, there are a lot of bullet points here, but lump sum sales generally have always been the traditional means of selling timber in many places. It requires generally a cash at closing to be paid by the buyer, and contracts normally run about a year. And in this situation, the buyer, after paying for the timber, they take the title to the timber while it's on the stump, and they also take the financial and biological risk that of the holding the timber during the timber cutting contract, which may be, say, a year. The seller also takes a risk that they would sell the timber, and the timber prices would go up after the sale when the logging period of a year. It's paramount that the seller knows what the timber is worth before accepting any bids. And I would caution landowners to be aware of timber buyer cruises and those people who seem to work in both roles as a procurement interest in one day, and then the next day they're calling themselves a consultant. Some of the lump sum sales are usually found on higher grade and higher volume tracts, and obviously the buzzword for the landowner is to be sure to sell at the right time.
Okay, so there's a risk allocation model with lump sum that you don't have pay in pay as cut, but what are some of the timber sale issues in today's market that landowners should be aware of?
Well, we're in a situation now where the logging industry is really suffering, and I think we're in a situation where there's a real problem with quotas on delivery of the materials, which is a market function. We have much longer hauling and merchandising issues as a result of that. Some of the mills seem to be working on short-term price commitments, and these are basically in the pulpwood side, I think. And the timber sale contracts, the pay-as-cut sales, for instance, it's kind of forcing some of the timber buyers to have to come back to the landowner and say, these prices that we signed up for, we can't pay, and that's a problem. Although they do agree, and some of the new contracts are showing variable prices in that if the market goes up, they will pay higher, but if it goes down, they will pay less, which is an uncomfortable business position to be in. There's a lot of long waits at the mill. And also these short contracts, I think, are having a negative impact in some cases on BMP. There's more damage to get production. There seems to be some – the spirit of the business practices is of some concern, and that's just a hard time. It may be due to their competitive position. And there's also some questions as to the allocation of quota out there in the logging industry that I'm talking to.
Okay. Well, given these changes that you're seeing, do you still – what sale method, I guess I should say, do you recommend?
Well, the sale method has got to be geared toward the type of timber and the quantity and quality of the timber. But right now, I think we're going to see, and we have been seeing, fewer lump sum sales, except to the mills who have a primary product in mind. You will see them come out with lump sum bids, but the small buyers are having a hard time taking the inconsistency of prices and putting up a lot of cash with a volatile price structure of the products, especially the pulpwood, is knocking back their desire to get into a lump sum price. We're also facing a lot of tornado wood on the ground, salvage quota issues, and of course we also have pine beetle problems that come from that, and also spreading of invasive exotics. The thing I would tell you to be careful of is that in not all cases, but in a lot of cases, the timber buyers will always tell someone to cut their timber, and it may not be the best decision financially or biologically. And the last thing I would say is that thank goodness our trees don't read the Wall Street Journal. That's all I can say.
Okay, thank you, Ed. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to John Sellers, Steve McWilliams, Russell Richardson, and Frank Stewart. We also appreciate the contributions of Bronson Strickland, Alan Houston, Josh Love, and Ed Travis. As Ed Travis mentioned, the wood market is tightening. Mills have consolidated, with less competition and lower demand, the practices that we're accustomed to seeing are beginning to disappear. This makes professional management of your forest even more important. Selling timber is rarely a do-it-yourself proposition, and it's even less so in these difficult markets like we have right now. So keep in touch with your consulting forester and be ready for when the situation improves, as it surely will. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.